യോഗ്യേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So in the last session we were dealing with this unique yoga paradigm, we called, just like Buddha had a paradigm, you know, a paradigm based on the fundamental principle that this worldly life, the life in this world, birth, life, death, and different vagaries, pleasant and unpleasant experiences, represent an imperfect state of human existence. This is a fundamental principle. So which he called dukkha. In Buddhist paradigm, it is called dukkha. In, as I said, in Ayurvedic paradigm, it is called roga, or sickness or illness. In yoga paradigm, it is called, again, it is called heya, some unpleasant reality that should be got rid of. Dukkha is called. The same term is used by Vyasa and Patanjali. Patanjali is the original author of the sutra text, and Vyasa is the commentator. So the same word with Buddha used by Vyasa in his yoga paradigm, or Patanjali, both of them, uses the same term as dukkha. So that's called dukkha chaturvyuha, it is called. The quadrangle of dukkha, or grief, or sorrow. Now, the translation is often sorrow. So it should not be understood to be a very pessimistic, a negativistic paradigm. What it wants to teach us is that there's a higher, more sublime dimension to human life and existence. Because if life at the psychophysical level were perfect by itself, then we should not experience any kind of unpleasantness. But it is not real. It's not real. We face problems, which means this present state is not a perfect state. You find this in all traditions or religious traditions, you know. The idea of kingdom of God in Christianity, the idea of liberation or moksha in Buddhism and in Hinduism. And you find all this in all traditions you come across. This basic concept that we are coming from a state of perfection and we are heading for a state of perfection, this intermediary stage is a state of imperfection. Now, as I said, the last sutra that we discussed, that is, you have to remember, that is the 15th sutra of Sadhana Pada, means second chapter, the second pada you come across, Parinama Tapa Samskara Dukhehi Gunavritti Virodhacha Dukhameva Sarvam Vivekinaha. For those who are spiritually evolved, the present state of affairs in this world is something that we should go beyond, something that a state that we should transcend, this idea. So this is called the yoga paradigm, which you find in Patanjali, which is elaborated by Vyasa. Now, Vyasa explains this in his commentary, in Sanskrit commentary. Vyasa explains this. As I said earlier, just as in physical life we have this problem of a disease, a cause for the disease, recovery of health, and again treatment. Similarly, in in the totality of human existence, there is this reality of dukkha or a state of imperfection. Now, somebody may ask this question, does this make Patanjali's yoga system a pessimistic, a negativistic system of thought? No, actually it's very realistic. It is very realistic. Because what comes out is all our unpleasant experiences point out one reality, that there is a higher state of human evolution which doesn't come after death. And it is not a state that you experience after this life is over. It is a state of experience that we can have right in this world, in the midst of our day-to-day activities and secular duties and responsibilities. That is one aspect. And if you ask me the question, what's a practical benefit of it from a purely American point of view? In what way this yoga helps you in this world? Let us forget about God, spirituality, religion, mysticism, all that. In what way can this yoga paradigm be of some relief, some help, practical assistance in our day-to-day existence? The answer is this. When there is a problem in your life, in our life, it may be due to the death or maybe departure of a loved, near and dear person. It may be loss of wealth. It may be loss of job. It may be anxiety problems created by the work pressure, the tension which everyone goes through, which no one can deny. When all this happens, yoga tells you, well, you need not necessarily remain a victim of these problems. And you need not wait till your death to reach a higher state where everything is perfect, everything is happy. No. Right in the midst of your duties and responsibilities, we can change a perspective, our whole approach towards this phenomenon of human life. And that change of perspective will help us to live in this world without any of these problems. Anxiety, neuro. What, there may be problems at a physical level, at the psychological level, but problem need not necessarily shock us. We will be able to take these problems in our stride. That's the real benefit. That is the real roga. Roga means sickness or illness. As I said, you know, there is a paradigm in Indian medical science, in Ayurveda. So that is what Vyasa himself quotes, that Ayurvedic paradigm. By interpreting the yoga paradigm, Vyasa says, Yatha chikitsa shastram chadurvyuham rogo, yoga hedu arogyam bhaishajyam, ityevam idamapi shastram chadurvyuhameva, tat yatha samsara, samsara hedu moksho, moksho upaya iti. So Vyasa says, just as in the field of medical science, we have these principles, these contra-ankle, means illness, a cause for illness, then recovery of health and treatment. Similarly, in the context of human life, there is this chaturvyuha, these four fundamental principles. That means this life itself is an illness. This human life itself is an illness. That's why often I emphasize this point and again, yoga is a very optimistic, very positive, a very encouraging science and analysis of life. It is not a pessimistic thing, though the word Roga is used, it means sickness or illness is used. And the word dukkha is often used in yogic paradigm. But it always means a state of imperfection, which we feel when we are facing some problems in our everyday secular life. Okay, so this life itself is a state of imperfection, and there's a cause for this imperfection, and there's a way out. And the way out, the solution, all these are described, which is dukkha chaturvyuha in yogic paradigm. So first, Vyasa says, samsara is dukkha bahula samsara heyaka. So this round of, this rotation of birth, life and rebirth is a problem. This is a problem only from the highest transcendental point of view. As I said, you know, a problem is recognized to be a problem only for a person who really wants to go beyond the problem. A person who recognizes that there's a problem is able to do that because he has an inner desire to go beyond, to transcend the problem, to find a solution to the problem. So those who are highly evolved, even culturally evolved, not necessarily in spiritual life, those who are culturally evolved will always look for a higher dimension of human existence. This often happens when we have a shocking experience. But Patanjali and Vyasa tell us that if we can realize this reality before an unpleasant, shocking experience really comes, then we will not have any shocking experience. So if we can worry without or before a real problem emerges, then you will not have to worry. That's a parinama dukkha I explained earlier. So all these are problems for vivekinaka, those who are endowed with higher spiritual or cultural refinement. This state of affairs is a problem, which means you will not have to face a problem. Because once we realize that there's a problem ahead, then it won't be a problem. If you understand there is a traffic problem ahead, the roads are not good, you can change the roads, so you can avoid a problem. So that's a practical benefit. Then samsara hedu is Pradhana Purushayoha Samyogu Heya Hetuhu. The cause of this samsara is the association of Purusha and Prakriti. Here, to explain this, I had to describe a few important aspects of the Sankhya philosophy. What is the cause of this samsara? Now, at the beginning of this session, this series of classes, I explained that yoga psychology, Patanjali system, is a part of a higher system of philosophy, which is called yoga philosophy. And Patanjali is the original teacher of the system. Now, this Patanjali system is one of the six theistic systems of Indian thought system, Indian philosophy. Sankhya and Yoga, Nyaya and Vaisheshika, Vedanta, that is called Uttara Mimamsa, and Purva Mimamsa, is a ritualistic system. I explained all this in 2-3 sessions at the beginning of this yoga sessions, a few months back. So I won't go into those details. At the beginning of the class, I explained that the yoga system is part of the Sankhya philosophy. Now, what is Sankhya philosophy? That should be understood clearly. To know this concept of this samsara hetuhu, what is a samsara hetu? The real cause for this problem of imperfection in life in the form of round of painful birth, death and rebirth and so on. I pradhana purushayohu samyoga. That is the means. The association between Purusha and Prakriti. So this needs some explanation. So in yoga philosophy, which is related to Sankhya system, there are two fundamental categories, two fundamental philosophical categories or realities. The yoga system is an extension of Sankhya system of thought. In Sankhya system, which is expounded by Kapila, as I said, there is this dualism. That means two fundamental realities. One is Purusha, the other is Prakriti. Purusha is a conscious reality, but inactive. Prakriti or Pradhanam, Pradhanam is another name, is lifeless, but at the same time active, and the whole universe comes out of this Prakriti. So those who really want to study yoga psychology and yoga philosophy should have a basic understanding of this Sankhya system, because yoga psychology is rooted in Sankhya philosophy. So that should be understood. That's why we have to explain this. So according to the Sankhya system, the whole universe, including our mind, our senses of perception, you know, eyes and all the senses of perception, our mind, our intellect, our senses of action, the entire cosmos, all these constitute an evolute of Prakriti. So everything evolves out of Prakriti. Prakriti or Pradhana. So the first evolute, according to the Sankhya system, is the cosmic intellect, which is called Mahat or Buddhi. This system is very, very popular these days among scientists, among many modern thinkers, for the simple reason this Sankhya system is not necessarily a monotheistic system. It doesn't accept a creator God the way a monotheistic system accepts a God creating this world. Rather, it is a very scientific and rational analysis of the world in which we are living. It doesn't necessarily deny God, at least according to the later schools of Sankhya system, like Ishvara Krishna, Sankhikarya, that we all study today. But again, it is not rooted in the belief that God creates this world. God may have created this world, but we are looking around and we are trying to trace the effect to its final cause. We are looking around and finally we are trying to explain how and why all these phenomenal things came into existence. So the first entity is Prakriti or Pradhana, and out of it the first evolute emerges. It is called the cosmic intellect or Buddhi. And out of this cosmic intellect, the ego arises, which is called Ahankara in the yoga Sankhya terminology. And from this Ahankara, the five senses or organ, cosmic organs of knowledge, like the eyes and ears, etc., and the five karmendriyas, like the cosmic organs of action, like hands and feet, etc., all these emerge. And from the tamasic Ahankara, the five subtle elements called tanmatras, and from this tanmatras, the entire cosmic Mahabhudas emerge. Like that, according to the Sankhya system, there are total 24 cosmic principles. So in other words, interestingly, according to Sankhya system, the whole world is not a new creation. It is only a manifestation of something which already exists. It is a process of evolution. So the evolution theory that we later read about can be linked. And normally there are many philosophers in modern times who link the modern evolution theory to the Sankhya system. Of course, the Sankhya system is theoretical, but They say, according to many modern evolutionists, some of the aspects of modern evolutionary thought system is embedded in the Sankhya system. Now, why and how this evolution takes place? The evolution takes place because the Purusha, which is really consciousness itself, sometimes identifies itself with these different evolutes. That's what really happens when we misidentify ourselves with various vrittis and vasanas. You know, yoga is defined as yogaha chitta vritti nirodhaha. Yoga is nothing but cessation of the misidentification of our sense of self with different emerging modifications. So when we have an experience, that experience creates a vritti or a modification in our mind, and we identify ourselves with that particular experience, our mind takes the form of what we see, our mind takes the form of what we know by hearing or touching or listening or smelling. So whatever we pursue, our mind takes that particular object. That is called vritti sarupyam. So whatever happens in our life, our mind immediately, we ourselves completely identify with all these emerging modifications. And when this identification happens, what happens? When we go through an unpleasant experience, you start looking upon yourself as a person who experiences this unpleasant, unhappy experience. And that creates problems. Anxiety, depression, whatever it is. So when we identify ourselves as this psychophysical mechanism, this psychophysical system, we start identifying ourselves with all these vagaries, experiences, everything. So as I said, you know, on one occasion long back, I said, when we are traveling in a car in the morning, when we caught ourselves in a traffic jam, but you really cannot move backward or forward, and we know very well that whatever anxiety, whatever mental fatigue we go through, it is not going to have any effect on the traffic conditions. But still sitting inside the car, we get anxious, we lose balance, and we become depressed. We may not reach the airport on time, we may miss the flight, and so on. Now, all these mental efforts, which really create emotional fatigue, is not going to improve or to change the situation. But still, we go through this. It's a classic example is mentioned. In fact, this example, a similar example was mentioned in some early classical scriptures. It says, one of the commentators in Vijnana Bhikshu, who was a Buddhist, he says, suppose you eat a fruit, and if that fruit happened to be sour, not sweet, then you curse the fruit, curse the tree, curse yourself who took the trouble to get that fruit, which is the cause of all these problems. Now, Vijnana Bhikshu asked, why should we curse ourselves or the fruit or the tree? That doesn't improve the situation at all. If you take a decision, we'll be careful while choosing the fruit next time. Of course, you know, Vijnana Bhikshu, writing several centuries early, he was a Buddhist. He just gave the example from our ordinary life situation. In modern times, you can see, when we identify ourselves as a person, as nothing more or less than a psychophysical mechanism who is trying to reach the airport on time, and nothing less, nothing more, then you feel you're completely crushed. You're completely lost. Of course, we get out of this when the traffic moves, but then for some time, maybe it may be for half an hour, we completely lose our balance. Why? Because we identify ourselves as a psychophysical mechanism who is caught in a traffic for half an hour and who is facing the risk of missing the flight. So I'm just trying to translate an example from Vijnana Bhikshu's book into modern times. So that's what happened. So why? So this misidentification. If we can stop this problem of misidentification, we can get rid of many of the problems. Vedanta gives you a simple solution. Vedanta says, well, you have to live in this world, you have to face all these problems. How to get out of this problem? You link yourself to a transcendental reality, which is your real nature, which is called Atman Vedanta, which is really what Sankhya has called Purusha in Sankhya system. So Sankhya system is acceptable in Vedantic context only in its details, not in its conclusions, because Vedanta believes in the existence of one immanent, omnipresent, transcendental reality that is present in everything, everywhere, which is conscious by itself, which is ever free. This is our true nature. But Sankhya doesn't go into those details. Sankhya tells us that if we stop this problem of misidentification of our own sense of self with all the emerging modifications, and if we can always remember that we are the Purusha, the conscious self, the reality, then we can stop this misidentification with the modification, which is called Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. That takes us to the final liberation. So this misidentification is the result of some yoga. We are really Atman, the Purusha itself. But we forget that for a moment. And then we forget that our reality and start identifying ourselves with every single emerging thought currents, experiences, etc. When we fall sick, we feel we are this physical body, nothing more. So I may die. That's the end of it. So the fear comes. According to Vedanta, you know, the most terrible fear is the fear of death. We become poor, we become depressed. When poverty makes us unhappy, because we feel that if we are poor, we won't be able to live. If we lose job, we won't be able to live. So every problem is linked to some serious problem to our life itself, which is really death. Now, Yoga and Vedanta tells us that death is really not a big problem at all. And how do you, then nothing can shake you. The mother of all problems is the fear of death. If we can transcend that problem, then there'll be no problem in this world. It doesn't mean that we should ignore life or the realities of life. Not at all. That's why often modern commentators like Shankaracharya, you know, Yoga, Vyasa Bhashi, Vivaranam is the super commentary. But Shankaracharya makes that point again and again. Yoga is not at all pessimistic. It is not foolishly idealistic. In the sense, it is very realistic. It points its finger to some of the real problems that we face and teaches us the real solutions. So that's why the solution, total cessation of this association of Purusha and Prakriti, is the eradication of this problem. It's called Hanaha Samyogasya Atyantiki Nivritti, total cessation. This misidentification of our sense of self with all the emerging experiences and modifications should come to an end. Then what happens? Then we can live in this world, go about our work, face our problems with a smile, but not lazy. We will not be lazy or lethargic or indifferent or negligent to his duties and responsibilities. But we feel a great huge stone is taken off our shoulders. A huge burden is taken, removed from our shoulders. That's a real experience of yoga in practical life. If you practice yoga, you can live in this world with a smile always on your face. So that's why it's called samyogasya atyantiki nivritti. So liberation here doesn't mean a state of experience that comes after death. Here liberation is only a change of a perspective towards the whole reality of life and its problems that we all encounter in our everyday life. And in Hanupayaka, Sammik Darshanam. So what's the method for this eradication of this problem? Is the real true insight. What's the true insight? The insight, the real perspective, the real approach that we have to evolve is, but I have this body, this mind, this thing, but I am something more than that, much more than that. The real me is much more than the psychophysical mechanism. This is the means for eradicating this problem, and that is a true insight. It's called Sammik Darshanam. Sammik Darshanam means true insight, a comprehensive perspective, approach to the reality of our life. This is the last point in this Dukkha Chaturvyuha. Now, next sutra is 16th. Heyam Dukkham Anagatam. That is the 16th sutra of Sadhanapada. Means, now what is to be got rid of? The suffering which is yet to come. So that we have already explained this when we discussed the Parinama Dukkha, which we discussed earlier. You know, Parinama, Tapa, Samskara, Dukkhehi. Like that, you may already mention Gunavisheshacha, like we already mentioned here. The real problem. See, a real yogi, a person of wisdom, is able to look at a distance and become aware of the real nature of ourself and life, and that awareness makes him wise. So he understands that this endless birth, life and death is a lower stage, an imperfect stage. There's a higher stage to be reached. It is something to be transcended. That transcendence comes when we become aware of the imperfect nature of worldly existence. We are not running away from the world or worldly life, but we are trying to look at the reality of worldly life from a wise person's perspective. That's why, I know I already quoted earlier, Parinama Dukkhata Nama Pratikura Sukhavasthayam Abhi Yogi Nameva Krishnadi. A real yogi, a real wise person, a person who has developed a yogic perspective, is able to look far into his life, is able to have a real perspective, and understand that there is a higher life, higher dimension to our life. In the context of our daily life, this idea is explained in the Gita, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the fourth chapter. In the fourth chapter, Lord Krishna makes an interesting statement. Imam vivasude yogam proktavanaham avyam vivasvan manave praha manu ikshakave abravid evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo vidhu sakalena ihamahada yogo nashta parantava. Is a very wonderful statement in the fourth chapter of Gita, first and second verses. Is a very classic description of the wisdom of yoga and how frequently this yogic wisdom came to be misunderstood or misinterpreted. The first statement tells us that this great wisdom of yoga was taught by God in ancient times to sun. This is sun god Vivasvan. And so the sun god taught to his son Manu. Manu taught to his disciple Ikshvaku. And these were all different dynasties. Okay. Different dynasties of god, great emperors and kings and princes. Then evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo vidhu. The second verse says, so this great yogic wisdom, which was originally taught to the great kings, emperors and princes in ancient times, it was taught successively by great rishis to kings, and the kings taught to their disciples, and so on. Like that, through a succession of teachers and disciples, the yogic wisdom was preserved in ancient times. Then Lord Krishna says, so evam paramprapta praptam evam rajasya vidhu sa kali neha mahada yogo nashta parandava. Then second point is, this yoga was understood and practiced not necessarily by hermits in their hermitages alone, but the kings and emperors in their palaces, which really means men of action, those who were busy in the day-to-day life of social and political and national life. You mean yoga was practiced by people who lived in this world in the midst of their worldly obligations and responsibilities. Then he says, sa kalena iha mahada yogo nashta parantava. In the course of a long time, this yoga was lost. That's a literal meaning. Now, we are concerned with one important point in this verse. Rajasayaka means, this yoga was understood and practiced by the great kings in ancient times. They were not just worldly minded, ambitious kings who were going about conquering neighboring kingdoms. They were kings in external action, in the dynamism, in the efficiency, but they were rishis at heart. Means they were saints and sages at heart, but they were kings and emperors from all practical aspects. I mean, they had the heart and wisdom of a saint and sage and the dynamism of a king. So can you really combine the efficiency of an emperor and the wisdom of a saint or a sage? Let us say, if you can have a combination of a Napoleon and Socrates rolled into one. Human, from a psychological point of view, it may not be possible. But that's a real paradigm of yoga in actual life, according to Lord Krishna. So, if you have only efficiency, if you have only external dynamism, and if you don't have the wisdom of a saint within, then you are a slave to external nature. And if you have only the wisdom of a saint without any efficiency, without any dynamism, that would help you to live successfully in this world, then you may not be able to live in society. You may not be able to solve the problems of life in this world. So Shankaracharya's commentary says, Rajanascha Rishayascha Rajasreka. I mean, who is a Rajashi? This is a very interesting term is you coined in Sanskrit. It says Samastapada. That means a compound word. People who were kings, Rajanaha, and Rishaya means sages. So they had the contemplative nature, the spiritual wisdom of a saint meditating in a forest hermitage. At the same time, they were not running away from the obligations of social life. They were right in the midst of social life and social obligations. No, this is, in fact, the nature of a person or a society, for that matter, where yoga is practiced and preserved. There's a commentator, Shankarananda Saraswati, who wrote commentaries, Sanskrit commentary on Shankaracharya's commentary on Gita. He says, and he gives a very interesting description of who is this yogi. A very graphic description. He says, Rajatvam hi Aishwarya Sambhatir Rishitvam Tasyaka Sukshmartha Darsana Kshamatvam. I'm quoting this Sanskrit because, you know, you can imagine the wisdom of these great commentators. He says, the Shankarananda Saraswati says, what is the nature of a king? The nature of a king, at least in ancient times, not modern times. In ancient times, kings were very prosperous, very active. They had to be active, and they were naturally prosperous. They were living in this world. They had plenty of wealth. No, but they were, this, but the difference is, a king who is a yogi will not be a slave of his senses. It's more or less reached like the philosopher king ideal of Plato in his Republic. Maybe, of course, there is a higher dimension, a spiritual dimension. Plato perhaps conceived the idea of a philosopher king in the context of the ancient Greek political social structure. But here you find a spiritual dimension. So the Shankarananda Saraswati in his commentary says, Rajatvam hi Aishwarya Sambhatti. The king, the status of a king is, the king is a very wealthy person. But a king who is not a yogi considers his wealth as an end in itself. But if he also becomes a rishi, a sage, then what happens? Tasyaha sukshmartha desanakshamettum. A sage understands that the wealth of a king, even of a king, is not everlasting. He can see the impermanence, the transitory nature, the non-eternal nature of wealth of even the richest trillionaire in the world. So that wisdom, to have an insight and also foresight into the true nature of material wealth, the true nature of the glory of the psychophysical body system. I mean, the ability to understand the truth that even the healthiest and happiest man or woman will die one day. The richest man will not be able to carry his bank balance when he dies. This, the ability to understand this truth is the unique feature of a sage or a saint. It's a rishi. So if you can combine this, the efficiency of a person who lives in this world successfully with plenty of wealth and a raja, and at the same time that higher spiritual insight of a sage, then you become a yogi. So, that's why, you know, Hanupayaka is Samyak Darshanam, means how to eradicate this problem of sorrow, the problem of imperfection. Not by running away from the world, but continuing to live in this world, but with a different perspective, which is called Samyak Darshanam, means the comprehensive spiritual insight. And this insight is the special contribution of the great sages and saints of the world. So that's what makes yoga a very practical, very realistic paradigm of life. So, you know, if you read, there are many who read translations of the great commentators, where you find, see, for example, Chitta Vritti Nirothaka, if it is translated, if you read just a simple translation without any explanation, that means the stopping of all cessation, complete cessation of your identification with the vritti, you go mad. You know the reason. If you completely stop identifying yourself with all emerging experiences. And if you sincerely try to do that, you go mad. So what yoga tries to do is to have a proper insight while identifying with these things, which slowly leads to cessation of this identification. As I said, you know, yoga has got vritti has got five dimensions. I already explained earlier. Kshiptam, vikshiptam, moodham, egagram, and nirutham. That means it's kind of complete restlessness, then obsession with something which makes you inactive, then you move from one idea to another idea, vikshiptam, then concentrating on one ideal, egagram, and then the final higher ideal, nirutham. These are the natural five states of vrittis, or the other states. I mean, five states of human mind on the basis of the functions of vrittis. These are five states of human mind based on the functions of vrittis. So, pramana, vivere, vikalpa, nidra, smrutayaka. These are five panja vrittis are there. These are five vrittis that we are living with. We are living the world of these five vrittis. You don't make a deliberate effort to stop these vrittis. You cannot do that unless you want to go mad. So what yoga tells us is how to transcend the fluctuations, how to transcend the disturbances created by the constant misidentification of sense of self with all the emerging experiences which create problems, anxieties, and how to make our mind stable and steady. So, I gave this picture of a real yogi. A real yogi is one who is not inactive, but active and at the same time endured with a higher wisdom, a higher insight into the transitory nature, the impermanent nature of all these worldly things. At the same time, he is living in the world. So that's a real insight, which means Sammyak Darshanam, the insight of a Rajashi. Sanskrit word means who is a king, so far as his actions, dynamism, efficiency, all these are concerned. At the same time, he is a saint, so far as his mental stability, contemplative nature is concerned. The contemplative nature of a saint or a sage and the active, efficient character of a king or an administrator rolled into one. That's the true nature of a yogi. That is called Sammyak Darshanam. So it is very realistic. It helps us to live in this world of empirical realities with a new spiritual, psychological equipment. Higher wisdom. It's called Sammyak Darshanam. That's what Vyasa calls Hanupaya is Sammyak Darshanam. Mean the real spiritual insight. Now, so we'll continue the classes in the next session. Now, there's an announcement which I want to make before we start interaction. We will not have class the next two Fridays. That is October 9, October 16. So there will be no classes on October 9 and October 16th, the next two Fridays. That means the next class will be on Friday, October 23rd at 7:30 p.m. So, no interaction.
Changing. So that's what active is.
Yeah.
Not changing. Yes.
There's a metaphysical fallacy in Sankhya system, which is pointed out by Vedantins. Now, if Purusha is conscious, then how can that Purusha be omniscient, become, how can it know things? And if Prakriti is inactive, how can it cause evolution? The whole cosmos evolves out of Prakriti. And Prakriti is described as jada, means inactive, devoid of consciousness. How can the whole universe gradually evolve out of Prakriti, which is active but unconscious? How can an unconscious thing be active? So there is a fallacy in the Sankhya system. So that's why Sankhya system is remarkable only for its details. A description of human intelligence and how the prasatika ahankara gives birth to mind. Many of these things are realistic. And the idea that the effect is not a new creation, but the effect already pre-exists in the cause. That is a satkaryavada. So parinama and satkaryavada means it's an evolutionary theory. So Sankhya system is based on the fundamental principle that Prakriti evolves and becomes the universe. So it's a doctrine of evolution. So there are many fallacies, many imperfections in Sankhya system. It's a kind of atheistic dualism. So it's dualism, and it is a kind of atheistic pluralism also, because it doesn't affirm the existence of a God emphatically. So, but the point is, Sankhya is now, right now, Sankhya system is relevant only in the context of yoga. And yoga system is extremely relevant because yoga explains some of the intricacies of human life, human existence, human mind, its functions, etc. The ultimate conclusion is not always acceptable. But how the working of the human mind, description of the human mind, how the mental world is divided into experience and also a reaction to that experience, called, you know, bhoga and udvega or vega, means the whole universe, mental universe, can be divided into these two categories. Experience on the one hand, and our reaction, emotional, volitional reaction to those experiences, which creates different mental modifications. And also description of mental condition into the five categories. So these are highly scientific and highly psychological. That's how yoga system has become very, very relevant in modern times. In some commentaries, the great commentators are given insight. One commentator, for example, says, suppose you forget for a moment your true nature and you get trapped by some temptations or by some things, that you may have to wait for several births to come back to this awareness. That means whole human existence is conceived in the context of innumerable birth, life and rebirths. Which means, suppose we read yoga today, we do a lot of contemplation, we try to adjust our life to many of these higher spiritual principles. But then, one moment you forget for a minute. And, you know, maybe that unguarded moment can become disastrous. You're caught. And then you may have to wait for many births to come back again to the present state of evolution. So some commentators say, suppose you're walking the road and you find Vedanta Society, suddenly you remember there's a yoga sutra classes going on. You feel like stepping into it. You know the reason? If you believe the commentators, you have to say it's because you have listened to these maybe 1,000 years back in some previous life. But then lost your track. Now you remember. Oh, yoga. Suddenly, those samskaras, you know, because that chakra is there, you know, that cycle, action, modification, samskara, vasana, sankalpa, action, again modification, like that goes on the cycle. So suddenly, when we read a book, when we suddenly come across a great spiritual idea, we feel greatly attracted towards that. That's because something we had done in the past, we stop somewhere, we are again going for a revision of it. Now, this idea is being taken very seriously by modern mainstream psychologists who try, as I said on many occasions, who try to interpret many of the problems, many of the problems on the basis of these two fundamental principles, the doctrine of rebirth and the doctrine of karma, its cause, that link. So that's the idea. So many of these great ideas that you find the Patanjali system as hints and the commentators as elaborate descriptions are very, very scientific, very rational. You don't find such thorough rational description in any other system of thought. That's a unique contribution of Patanjali. So, here again, look at the Parinama Dukkha principle, which is a real contribution of Patanjali. He says, if you can worry before a problem arises, then you will not have to face the problem. So you worry now before the real problem comes, then you will not have to face the problem. You will be ready for the problem. So it won't be a problem at all. A problem is a problem when it comes, when it hits you by surprise, when we are not ready for it. If you are ready for it, it's not a problem. That's why he's a viveki, a real person of discrimination, discerning mind, will worry before the real cause of worry emerges, so that he will not have to worry. Such wonderful insight you find in the yoga system. That's why it is studied and taught, not necessarily by people who belong to any particular religious tradition or even... Many of the commentators were agnostics. Many commentators were Buddhists who did not believe in a monotheistic God. And they have also thrown wonderful insight into the yoga system. Vijnana Bhikshu was a Buddhist. That's one example. Yeah, you know, it's not that we get a clear understanding of a definite, specific problem that is going to come. The understanding that life in this world, at the world empirical level, cannot be always perfect. Pain and pleasure are inevitable parts of life in this world. This wisdom. So that wisdom enables you to look upon pain and pleasure with a sense of equanimity. We may respond to those problems, we may solve those problems, but then we won't be surprised, we won't lose our balance. We will be able to keep a level of mental equilibrium even while confronting those problems.
So you're not saying specifically visualize certain
General. The whole perspective changes. So that's the idea. Whole perspective.
One other question. Do you have any specific meditations that you would recommend to go to practice beyond the misidentifications with the vrittis and the vasanas to the linking with the transcendental?
Yes. One method is to contemplate and try to look upon yourself as a witness of all these events, with not a participant, but a person who sees all this. These problems will arise, but you, the real you, is beyond all these emerging experiences. So that enables you to look upon all these from a higher perspective. I mean, you feel you are not a participant in all these, in the whole drama of human life and experiences. You are a witness. So, but remember, this is not a mental technique. The problem of using this as a mental technique is, if you use this as a relaxation technique, it may not fully work. It should be based on a solid philosophical reality. It means you are the Atman, you are the Self, it's beyond all this. All these experiences, pain and pleasure, all this take place, they happen, they occur at the empirical plane, at the level of the senses and mind. But I am something that goes far beyond, that transcends the mind, everything. So we should have a clear understanding and perspective as to what we really are. That's very important. In some meditation techniques, you may learn to look upon things as a witness. And if that is used as a technique for mental relaxation, it may work only for some time. But this should become a natural understanding of what you are. You should be able to look upon yourself as the real self, the consciousness, the Atman, that goes beyond all this. So that's very important. So, of course, in prisons and in some places, the other method may work, but its effect will not be permanent. It should be based on a very solid principle as to what, as we should know what we really are.
Yeah. We
are the Atman. So now I can, for there is one logical way of explaining this. We all know that we are something beyond this body, because we sometimes interpret ourselves as the mind, you know. And when you feel intellectually bored by reading a book or solving a problem in mathematics, you of course you are interpreting yourself as the intellect. But so anything that is subject to changes, happy now, unhappy next day, next moment, cannot be our true self. But am I something other than all this mind, intellect, body and so on, which are subject to changes and fluctuations? Anything that changes cannot be permanent. Anything that is subject to fluctuations cannot be permanent. But the real I goes beyond all this. So, and that real I is Atman. Once you try to look upon yourself as the Atman, then you are equipped with a solid philosophy, not just a psychological technique. So, this should be very important. We are the consciousness, we are the Atman. That conviction should be strongly emphasized.
What if we're not certain of that? What if we're not certain of that? For example, the Buddhists, they understand there's consciousness, but they don't look at it as necessarily permanent.
Yes.
How do we know that consciousness, for example, is not changing?
Well,
scientists,
yeah, scientists don't believe. So, there are many people who do not believe. And in some cases, people will need some experiences to force them to make them believe. People who are knocked about all over the world, every moment in their life, by unfortunate experiences, suddenly they, by reflex action, they may, well, am I something other than this? At that moment, if you read a book on this, suddenly it strikes you. Or if you really become a seeker of truth, then also you can read the same thing. But if you look for a convenient thought system, then Vedanta cannot satisfy curiosity. Vedanta can only satisfy the curiosity of a spiritual seeker of truth, not intellectual curiosity. So that's the thing. That's why, you know, through the tools, I mean, judging by the tools of epistemology, by which we try to understand scientific things, inference, perception, and so on, we will not be able to recognize the need for spiritual life. The need for spiritual life doesn't come out of intellectual conviction. It comes out of conviction that has its source somewhere else beyond intellectual conviction. Through intellect, we may be able to analyze things, but when we reach a higher level of our own real self, we reach a stage where these things do not satisfy us. Where intellect fails to satisfy you, then only you feel the need for spirituality. That's natural. Otherwise, it is impossible. Of course, there are two types of intellectual curiosity. Sincere search for truth will take you to spirituality. But intellectual arrogance will not take us to spirituality. Sincere search for truth may one day help us to stumble upon the spiritual reality. That's true. But frequently we try to analyze things with tools which are imperfect, so far as spiritual problems are concerned. For example, why should you feel unhappy with this world? There are many people, plenty of money, plenty of wealth, everything, job, security, everything is there, but not very happy. So they cannot get satisfaction from any other sources. And this could happen to people who have nothing. They don't go for these things. They go for something higher. So at the both ends of the pendulum, you can find this search for truth. People who don't have anything, just because they don't care for anything, they go after spiritual life. A Shankaracharya started his search for truth when he was 6-year-old, 7-year-old. Jesus, you know, arguing with his elders in this registration, you know, when the Emperor Augustus declared the census, you know, he went and argued with the wise men in the synagogue, temple. So you find such examples on both ends. And there are those who are great emperors and kings who didn't go for anything else, they go after some higher truth. So both ends you find. So it's very difficult to clearly state when you really start your inquiry for spiritual truth. But one point should be understood. The tools of intellect or intellectual inquiry are inadequate for understanding spiritual ideas. That's one fundamental principle.
So I guess
So any other question? Of course, we have already reached time. So we'll conclude now. So please remember, our next class will be on October the 23rd, Friday at 7:30. Thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.